Welcome to the Spring of Sustainability, a production of the SHIFT Network and the Sustainable World Coalition, and hosted this week by the Endangered Species Coalition as part of a celebration for this year's 9th Annual Endangered Species Day. I'm Mike Leonard, a retired United States Marine and also an environmentalist. I serve on the board of directors of the Endangered Species Coalition and live near Lake Michigan, one of the world's largest freshwater seas. But today, we're going to talk about vanishing species in our oceans. 71% of our Earth's surface is covered by oceans, and it is a major resource tapped by nearly every nation on the globe. However, that seemingly inexhaustible supply is changing, and many of the species we took for granted are in peril. With me today are three speakers with unique qualifications to talk about those concerns and to suggest what we might do to reverse the damage we are seeing in our oceans. Joining us are Sarah Young, a marine scientist for Oceana's Climate and Energy Team. She is working to incorporate new and exciting science about marine mammals and ocean acidification to prevent the expansion of offshore drilling and promote offshore wind energy. Before coming to Oceana, Sarah was a member of the policy team for the Consortium of Ocean Leadership, working on projects such as the Gulf of Mexico Research Initiative and the National Ocean Sciences Bowl. She also worked in the Marine Animal Rehabilitation Center, focusing on returning seals, turtles, and porpoises back to their natural habitat. Sarah holds a Bachelor of Science in Marine Biology and Master's degree in Marine Mammal Science from the University of St. Andrews. You'll find Sarah wrestling seals, spotting whales, and freezing on some deserted beaches, all for the sake of marine conservation and loving every minute of it. Sarah's website is www.oceana.org. Also with us is Lee Crockett. Lee's expertise is maintaining ocean fish in the face of climate change. Mr. Crockett joined the Pew Charitable Trust in 2007. He serves as director of U.S. Oceans, where he leads Pew's efforts to establish policies to end overfishing and promote ecosystem-based fisheries management under the authority of the Magnuson-Stevens Fishery Conservation and Management Act. As director, Lee oversees all of Pew's U.S. fisheries campaigns, including efforts in the Northeast, South Atlantic, Gulf of Mexico, U.S. Caribbean, Pacific, and North Pacific. Before joining Pew, he was executive director of the Marine Fish Conservation Network, the largest national coalition dedicated exclusively to promoting the sustainable management of ocean fish. Under his leadership, the network played a key role in reauthorization of the MFA. Previously, he was a fishery biologist with the National Marine Fisheries Service, leading agency efforts to protect essential fish habitat. He also served as a staff member of the House Committee on Merchant Marine and Fisheries, working on a variety of fisheries, environmental, and boating safety issues. Lee has a Bachelor of Science in Biology and a Master's in Biological Oceanography from the University of Connecticut. Prior to attending college, he served in the U.S. Coast Guard. He is also an avid angler who enjoys fishing the Potomac River and Chesapeake. You can reach Lee at the Pew website, www.pewenvironment.org. Finally, we have Nora Pouillon. Nora is a pioneer and champion of organic, environmentally conscious cuisine. Born in Vienna, Austria, Nora came to Washington, D.C. in the late 60s. She was shocked to discover the processed, chemical-laden foods Americans were eating, which she realized contributed to their health problems. That's when she embarked on her crusade to promote a healthier lifestyle. In the 70s, Nora began to develop an extensive network of organic and natural farmers, personally driving out to farms in the Washington, D.C. area to purchase local produce and meats for her family and her cooking class and catering business. When she opened Restaurant Nora in 1979, she continued to use these farmers to supply the restaurant with seasonal organic produce while introducing other D.C. chefs to the farmers as well. She also initiated D.C.'s first producer-only farmers market called Farm Fresh Market, Fresh Farm Market, which now includes 11 markets in the metropolitan area. By the mid-1990s, nearly all of the products used at Restaurant Nora were certified organic. Nora has been instrumental in establishing organic certification standards for restaurants. In 1999, Restaurant Nora became the first certified organic restaurant in the United States, a feat accomplished by few cents. Nora tirelessly advocates her commitment to nutritionally wholesome foods and a sustainable health-focused lifestyle based on the premise that you are what you eat, drink, and breathe. This philosophy not only extends to a restaurant, but also to their outreach work. Each year, Nora hosts five women chefs and restaurateurs, in the restaurant, and she sits on the board of the directors of 7 food and environmental organizations. Nora is the author of Cooking with Nora, a seasonal menu cookbook that was a finalist for the Julia Child Cookbook Award, and she is currently working on her memoirs. You can reach Nora at her website, www.noras.com. I'd like to begin with Sarah and ask her to tell us about her work, how the oceans are changing, and what might be done to reverse the species depletion we are seeing throughout the world. Take it away, Sarah.
Sure. Thank you very much. I'm Sarah Young. I'm a marine scientist with Oceana's Climate and Energy Campaign. Oceana is the world's largest marine conservation organization. We focus solely on marine conservation around the world. Our climate and energy team, based in Washington, D.C., focuses on stopping oil drilling in the Atlantic, trying to close drilling in the Gulf of Mexico, and promoting renewable energies such as offshore wind. So in relation to endangered species, as that's what we're here for today, Atlantic drilling poses a serious problem. Right now, the government has put forward a proposal to allow seismic air gun testing to occur in the Atlantic, which is the precursor to drilling. This seismic testing is basically air guns hung off the back of a boat that shoot compressed air down to the seafloor to create an image of what lies beneath, primarily oil reserves, which come back to the ship and are received as maps and sold to oil companies so they know where to drill. However, these blasts of compressed air are incredibly loud, 100,000 times more intense than you would experience if standing near a jet engine. And they can go on every 10 seconds for days to weeks on end, and the survey period would likely be years. And this sort of proposed area in the Atlantic not only is right in the fishing grounds of so many important commercial and recreational fisheries for communities, but also directly in the critical habitat designated for the critically endangered North Atlantic right whale. It's estimated that there are only about 500 left. They have a very small designated critical habitat in the southern United States Atlantic coastal area near Georgia. And this blasting is slated to go on right in those areas. And if you have such a critically endangered species that requires protection, it just seems to make sense that this is not what we should be doing in that area. Again, the blast zone also covers the habitat of 6 other endangered marine mammals in the Atlantic coast, most of which have not been addressed in the government's current proposal. So we are doing everything we can to try and push that back and make sure that this process does not go forward, and if it must, that it is properly cited and properly studied. As I'm sure we will discuss later, essential fish habitat, which is incredibly important to ensure the success of our commercial fisheries, was completely glossed over in the government's proposal as well, which could pose serious economic consequences for thousands of coastal communities along the Atlantic. So we are doing our best to try and prevent this drilling from continuing in the Atlantic. Our website is full of information for people who want to know more, and I'm sure we'll talk about later exactly how you can get involved in helping us stop this effort.
Well, thank you very much, Sarah. I'm going to move to Lee and then get back to you on that topic. But Lee, you've been in this business a long time. So why don't you tell us about your work and what you've seen, particularly in the changes to ocean quality since you first began studying our oceans?
Okay. Thanks, Mike. To do that, I have to give a little brief history of how we manage our fish in the ocean because it's pretty unique. I'm also going to talk about some of the successes that we've had recently over the last decade or so, and then some of the challenges that climate change is bringing on into the equation, and then the solutions to create a more healthy ocean. And so the history is before 1976, there was lots of foreign fishing off of our waters. It was sort of the Wild West. We had factory trawlers from Asia and the Soviet bloc fishing as close as 12 miles from our coast, and they really decimated our fish populations in New England and the Pacific coast. So in 1976, the Congress passed what we're now calling the Magnuson-Stevens Fishery Management Fishery Conservation and Management Act, which phased out that foreign fishing, established an exclusive fishery management zone within 200 miles of our shores, and created a unique management system where fishermen played an integral role in management. The law was a great success in getting rid of the foreign fishing, but it was too good at promoting the U.S. fleet. So by the late 80s and 1990s, we had replaced foreign overfishing with U.S. overfishing, and species like cod in New England and red snapper in the Gulf of Mexico had dwindled to dangerously low levels. So in 1996 and again in 2006, Congress added new conservation provisions to the Madison-Stevens Act that shifted the focus of management from promoting fishing to conserving fish. Most notably, in 1996, Congress required the timely rebuilding of depleted fish populations, and in 2006, it mandated an end to overfishing. So today, we've actually made pretty good progress ending overfishing and rebuilding depleted populations. We have examples like Atlantic bluefish and lingcod on the West Coast that have been restored. And looking at the big picture, the number of federally managed ocean fish populations that are subject to overfishing, and overfishing is simply defined as catching fish faster than they can reproduce, has decreased from 72 fish populations to 28 in 2013, and 34 depleted fish populations have been rebuilt since 2000. So from a single species management standpoint, we've done a pretty good job and we're moving in the right direction. But we have new challenges to the ocean ecosystem from global climate change, and we think it requires a different approach to management. So as I said, current fishery management focuses on the health of individual fish populations, largely in isolation from the larger ecosystem. We have management that allows fishing that destroys bottom habitats like corals and grasses, as well as football sized or larger nets to capture everything in their path. In addition, we have fisheries for forage fish, and these are things like herring and sardines, with little regard for how many of them we need to leave in the water as food for marine mammals and birds and other fish. On top of these serious challenges, we have warming water and acidifying waters that are the result of climate change or increased carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So warming waters are driving fish species away from the equator towards the poles and from nearshore waters to offshore deeper waters as they search for cooler water. For example, 2012 marked the warmest year on record in the Gulf of Maine, and historic fish like cod are moving north into Canada, while fishermen are catching things like cobia, which are a southern species that you would find in North Carolina South, are moving into Buzzards Bay off of Massachusetts. And acidifying waters are harming shellfish and corals by dissolving their shells. And that's a big problem in the Pacific Northwest and also in New England waters. And so what can we do about that? Well, we think we need a new approach to fishery management that focuses on restoring and conserving healthy and resilient ocean ecosystems. To do this, we need to shift towards ecosystem-based fishery management. We're not talking about managing the entire ecosystem. Rather, we're talking about making fishery management decisions based on their impact on the larger ecosystem. Right now, Congress is beginning the process of updating the Madison-Stevens Act and is discussing some proposals to promote ecosystem-based management. Unfortunately, it is also considering amendments to weaken the Act. We need to make sure that Congress maintains and builds on the Act's current conservation management so that we can better face these new global challenges. We're suggesting that the Madison-Stevens Act be updated to protect and restore our ocean ecosystems by including measures to protect marine habitat, reduce the waste from non-selective fishing, ensure enough forage fish for the bigger fish and other ocean wildlife that depend on them for food, start new fisheries smartly. Currently, a fishery can start without any information on its potential impacts or any management measures in place to minimize those impacts. Only when problems appear do managers step in. That needs to change. We need to start smart. And then finally, we need to plan for the whole ecosystem. Fishery management should be guided by ecosystem plans instead of by decisions on a single species of fish without regard to the health of other species, their common habitat, or the impacts of the fishery on the broader marine environment. And Mike gave our website. If you go on our website, there is plenty of information about our work on fisheries in the United States and around the world. So there's lots of additional information, and if people want to, you know, get involved in this work, there is a take action button on the right side of our webpage, and you click that, and then there's a bunch of action alerts. We don't have anything up currently on fishery management in the United States. Most of it's on forest issues and wilderness protection. But you'll see there's boxes you can check. So you can check boxes if you're interested in fisheries, forage fisheries, tuna, things like that. And then we send out periodic updates and action alerts and things like that. So if you want to get involved in this work, that's the way to do it, through us. And many other NGOs in the United States are involved. Certainly Oceana is involved in this work, the Ocean Conservancy, the Natural Resources Defense Council, all of them are actively involved in making sure the Magnuson Act stays strong and moves into the 21st century with more of a focus on ecosystem-based fishery management. Thanks.
Thanks so much, Lee. And we're going to circle back to you as well, but I wanted to give Nora an opportunity to talk about what she's done. And, you know, it's great, Nora, to have a fellow foodie on the panel. We grow most of our food on my farm here in Michigan. So after the panel, we're going to have to trade recipes. But I'd like to ask you to talk a little bit about what you've done moving those fish from the ocean to the kitchen.
I think, as you mentioned before in my introduction, I'm sort of a pioneer in a more environmentally healthy for us and healthy for the environment. So, you know, 20 years ago or so, I realized that the fish that I bought, for instance, the swordfish, became smaller and smaller before I got these enormous center cut steaks. And then suddenly there were these smaller little steaks, and when I asked my purveyor what's happening, he said, they ain't out there anymore. And it gave me really a wake-up call. And I started to ask questions and research it a little bit, and that's when I realized that our wild population of fish gets completely decimated, like, I don't know, the buffalo on the prairie or, you know, and that we're coming back in a completely new era of where there's not enough anymore wildlife out there in the oceans, and that we start to get into farming. And so I realized two things. I did two things. One of them, I became very involved in a campaign to save the swordfish. It was called Give Swordfish a Break, that was initiated by NRDC and C-Web, and I got like 100 chefs to promise not to serve swordfish on their menu for at least 1 year, and then we extended to a second year, and I think it saved the Atlantic swordfish because most of the fishing was going on off the coast of South Carolina where the breeding grounds are. And swordfish, I think they have to be, if I remember correctly, 9 years old before they can reproduce, so they were fishing teenagers, and so we had no more future generations. And the more I looked into it, the same thing happened then with the Chilean sea bass, you know, pass on Chilean sea bass. I was involved with that too, and then with Caspian caviar. And so what I decided in my restaurant to do is to pay attention to several things. One of them is that I would not buy any fish that is endangered. And I think there are more and more fish that are endangered. And I, for instance, I don't serve any orange ruffy, any swordfish, any shark, any the rockfish in the Chesapeake Bay was completely decimated too. Because there was a moratorium after, I don't know, 10 years. Actually, we could have it again, but now there's another problem. The problem is the polluted water. And of course, tuna. And there are many fish out there that I think you can fish, and there are countries, especially Canada, and I think the United States does it too, where there are seasons. You know, when you shoot a game, you have a certain season where you can shoot a deer or you can shoot a certain bird. Well, the same thing is for fish, and I just really pay attention to that, not to do really only when it is in season to buy that kind of fish that is like salmon and halibut and black cod. So this is one thing. The other thing is that I'm really very concerned with the pollution of our waters. I think our waters are just getting more and more polluted. When I came here in the 60s, it was the Chesapeake Bay was bad, but it's even worse now, even so people tell me it's on the move up. But when I came, there was a big sign on the Potomac, don't even put your toe in that water. And the Chesapeake also, all the oysters start to buy, and all the oyster fishermen got out of business, as they say, the watermen on the Chesapeake. So it really gave me a scare, and the more I looked into it, I realized that there are these dead zones now. There's a dead zone, an enormous dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico. You probably know much better than I do, but I heard that it was the size of the state of Connecticut, and that in the Chesapeake there's also an enormous dead zone. The other thing that I am now concerned, as I sort of touched about it before, is the farmed fish, because we got rid of all our wild fish, or most of it. Now businesses start to farm fish, but the same thing happens with farm fish that's happening with our beef. You know, it's this Kansas mega feeding lots, you know, just to pump out the beef without any consideration of the nutritional value or of the animal welfare, or you know, of the people that have to kill those animals. Well, I mean, it's like really a bad scene. On top, they're fed all these grains that are now genetically modified, and because they can't digest the grains, they need all these antibiotics, and all this is into the meat, and that's what we eat. And then we think it doesn't affect us. Well, unfortunately, the same thing happening with the fish. So the fish that is farmed off in cages off coastlines, much too many fish in one of these cages, so they have to give them antibiotics. They also develop a terrible disease called lice on their skin that are little tumors, so they are given a chemical called splice. I mean, it's the same kind of thing as happening with beef is now happening with fish. So I don't really buy any farmed fish, except if I know exactly where the farm is, how the farm treats its animal or the environment, and how what they give them to feed, so they don't exploit all the ocean with their small fish, and how they treat them. So my partners and I have a sustainable fish business where my partner goes out all over the world to find small fishermen who still do it the old-fashioned way with hook and line. And if they have fish farms, they really do it in a sustainable way, not exploiting the ocean and not polluting the environment where the fish farms are in. I mean, to the point where the cages have no copper in it, because, I mean, it gets very technical and very involved. Of course, now on top with the farmed fish, they are talking about genetically engineered fish like salmon. It becomes very scary. And if you hear about the shrimp farming, it's even more scary. Well, they do things like what they call, I think, ablating, where they cut off one eye from the shrimp so that it completely changes their reproductive cycle. Also, there are in the wild, but there are about, in farms, there are like, let's say, I'm not very good with numbers, but about 100 shrimp, 100 to 150 shrimp in a cubic meter. If they're in the wild, they are like 10 to 15, to give you an idea how they should live so that they can really be sustainable and eat without being fed, and eat just from the environment. They're mostly in mangroves, and they eat, you know, the fallen leaves and the roots or whatever is in the mangroves. My last comment is that I had to wait 10 years for the laws or the standards to come through for the organic certification for food, and it has been over 5 years I think nearly seven, since the government has been debating the standards for farmed fish, and I'm a bit advocate so that they would move ahead perhaps and be a little speedier, because I think we are doing the same bad things that we did for beef. We're doing it right now with fish. And since we know or we have learned our lesson from all the beef, what we can do better, why not apply it to our fish farms? And since fish farms basically have to be there, because there's just not enough wild fish out there anymore to feed us as people. So so these are the things I'm working on, and I hope it was helpful.
Well, thank you, Nora. It certainly was. And before I go back to the panel to ask some questions of them, I wanted to remind our listeners that that they can ask questions as well. So if you're on a phone or a touchtone, just push one, and it will let our folks know that we should bring you into this discussion. But I'd like to start with Nora and ask her a question. For those of us that aren't experts like you, and we all go to the grocery store and we all shop, what kinds of fish should we be looking for? What the particular species or conditions of their raising should we be checking for in the grocery store when we shop for fish?
Well, there are many now guides out there. You know, the Monterey Bay Aquarium put out something called Seafood Watch, and it's a tiny little sort of guide that you can have, and it has different categories for you know, green the best choice, and you know, sort of yellow for a good alternative, and red for something definitely to avoid. I think there's also the Audubon Society that brings out a label, and then there is the Marine Stewardship Council MSC label. That's a good guideline to look if the fish has any of these criteriums or labels. There are still lots of good fish, as I say, but you have to buy it in season. For instance, right now in season is the halibut and the black cod or sable fish. It's my favorite fish, actually, black cod. It's a wonderful fish. It's a deep water fish. It used to be the bycatch of the halibut, but it became quite popular. It's also the season now for wild salmon. Right now it's the Columbia River king salmon. Then there are the crabs from Maine. I buy now only crabs from Maine because, as I said before, I think the Chesapeake is too polluted. Piquito crabs. I don't buy any soft-shell crabs when they come from Florida, because why decimate Florida? Because we have decimated all our shoreline. Now we move more and more south, so I feel that we should just wait until it comes up here and then restrict ourselves and not have six soft-shell crabs per meal. I think one or two is plenty. And then there's trapped bass, there's black bass, there's actually a blue catfish right now in the Chesapeake or on the East Coast that is very sustainable. Actually, we should really eat it because it is very destructive. There's mahi mahi, there is squid, there's rainbow trout. I mean, there are many, many options and many alternatives. I think most people just are familiar with three varieties of fish, and they always stick with them. And one of them, unfortunately, is the swordfish or the Atlantic cod or the tuna, the bluefin tuna, and I think, or the yellowfin tuna, and you know, there are many other options out there. We can, you know, the other tunas, and then there is also, as I said, the halibut and the black cod, my favorite fish. So that's what I would do. And of course, there are mussels that are farmed, and then there's the scallops from Northeast that are farmed, Dable scallops. And so I think we have plenty of options. I think what we have to think at the same time is the size of our portions. We don't need so much protein. We don't need such a big piece of fish or a big piece of meat. We just need, like, I think 4 ounces is the maximum, probably between 3 and 4, that's what we should aim on.
Okay, well, thanks, Nora. You're making me hungry you're describing some of the delicious alternatives that we have. But I'd like to move back to Lee. Lee, you know, we've seen the benefits of the Endangered Species Act, and it seems that the Magnuson-Stevens Act, particularly if it's strengthened with sensible laws or sensible regulations, can do a lot to help our ocean fisheries. And, you know, it seems what you were describing in your earlier discussion was habitat management or multiple species management as opposed to single species. And could you tell us a little bit more about what needs to go into this act to make sure that it protects future generations of species and ensures that they're available to future generations of humanity?
Sure. I think the first place we have to start is we got to make sure that the act doesn't get weakened, and that's a significant threat. There's a big push, primarily from fishermen from New England, where they have successfully pretty much decimated their groundfish stocks through allowing overfishing to go on for decades and refusing to cut their quotas, so that now that the stocks are, you know, just a fraction of what they were. So, you know, as Nora was talking about, cod from New England, if you go to Cape Cod and you order some cod, you're probably getting cod from Iceland or the North Sea. You're not getting it off of Cape Cod. So unfortunately, a lot of the fishing interests up there want relief from these requirements that were put in place in 96 and 2006. And it's, you know, forced them to cut the quotas significantly. But the sad part is there seems to be no fish. They have very reduced quotas, and they can't even catch their quotas. There's so few cod and other what they call the ground fish stocks, the fish that live on the bottom. So that's the first thing we got to do. We got to make sure the act stays strong. And then Sarah was talking about essential fish habitat. The managers need to do a better job of protecting habitat, these corals and kelp beds and seagrasses and things like that, that if you drag a bottom trawl across them, it just cleans it off. And some of the ways they catch, for example, sea scallops is really it's like a road grader. It's a metal blade and a metal fence, and it digs 5 or 6 inches into the bottom, and it's real good at catching scallops, and it's real bad for the bottom habitat and other fish that it might run into. So not only that's when we talk about habitat protection, we're talking about restricting those kinds of damaging fishing operations from sensitive habitats. It's okay to use a scallop dredge in a soft sandy bottom, but not in an area with sensitive habitats or things you don't want a road grader driving over. And then there's a bunch of fisheries that are sort of industrial scale. They have large nets that scan, go for a mile, and they could be a football field down into the water. These are called gill nets, and anything that swims along gets caught in these things. And so they use them to catch swordfish and other things like that, but they're also catching a bunch of sharks, sea turtles. On the West Coast, they even caught a couple of whales in these things recently. And there was a push to expand them into an area that was put in place to protect sea turtles. And sea turtles are some of the most endangered marine animals. And so they had areas protected where they knew those sea turtles congregated, and fishermen wanted to get in there and use these nets in there. And Pew, along with Oceana and other groups, have successfully blocked that. And we're looking to get that fishery phased out. But there needs to be stronger legislation, you know, in the reauthorization of the Magnuson Act to get them, to make them get serious all across the country on minimizing bycatch and promoting more selective fishing gears to protecting habitat. And then I talked a little earlier about forest species. And these are, you know, critically important links between the microscopic plants and animals, which these forest fish eat, and then the larger predators. So you're talking about the forage fish are things like herring, sardines, menhaden, things like that are food for striped bass, cod, marine mammals, whales, dolphins, and birds. A variety of birds eat these things. And so managers historically have only thought about how much fishing can that population withstand without declining. They don't think about how much needs to get left in the water to feed the rest of the ecosystem. So this is one of the areas that Pew has focused a lot of its efforts on. And we've had some successes, particularly on the Atlantic coast with menhaden. Along with some of our partners in the commercial and fishing, recreational fishing industry and other NGOs, got the coastal states along the Atlantic to cut the quota by 25%. And that means we've got the numbers now from the first year, and they've actually met that quota, that reduced quota. That means another 300 million menhaden in the water to feed the rest of the ecosystem. And the industry that catches these, now these things are what they call a reduction fishery. They suck them up and cook them down, and they where you get your omega-3 tablets from is the oil that comes out of these fish. And then they use the flesh and the bones and things like that are used for poultry feed and aquaculture feed. So the company that does that is out of Virginia. They said they were going to really be harmed by this reduction. Turns out to be not true. They've had their best year ever. And they've actually bought two new boats. So, you know, it's an example of where we've done something good for the environment, where there's a lot more of these fish in the environment, and it really hasn't harmed the industry at all. And then we need to sort of take a step back in our management and think about how what we're allowing is impacting the larger ecosystem. We need to develop these planning documents that sort of describe how the ecosystem works and how you might measure its health, how so you can track whether it's getting better or worse. And there's been a lot of work in the scientific community on this, and what we need is the managers to start adopting that process so that the end point is to have a more healthy, resilient ecosystem, because you know, even if we stopped all the carbon input right now, we're still going to have the climate and temperatures increasing. There's still a bunch of carbon dioxide in the water that's going to be being absorbed into the ocean. And so the increase in temperatures and the increase in acidity in the ocean is going to go on for a lot longer, even if we stop right now, which is not likely. So we think you need to plan for that, to mitigate for that damage. And the best way to do that is to make sure we have healthy ecosystems, because they're better able to withstand these large-scale impacts.
Yeah, thanks, Lee. You know, on the subject of climate change, I saw a recent report that expanding ocean depletion zones in both the Atlantic and Pacific are being driven by the warming of the ocean. And my question is either for Sarah or you, Lee, about whether or not how these expanding zones of oxygen depletion are affecting some of our critical species. Either of you want to take that?
Go ahead, Sarah. I'll follow
right.
you.
Sure. So I will leave out some of the fisheries part. These expanding oxygen depletion zones are just one of the many effects of climate change manifesting itself in our oceans. And it has a huge effect across the ecosystem, across trophic levels. Primarily, when you think of oxygen, you think of plants, primary production. So the really tiny critters in the ocean that need this stuff, and they're the base of the entire food web in the ocean. So that leads to a decrease in primary production, which then means less food for the small forage fish. It also means less food for sea turtles, a less habitat for sea turtles who kind of nest in sargassum. Some of our largest whales eat some of the tiniest creatures, and those tiny creatures feed directly on, you know, the byproduct of primary productivity. So these kind of oxygen depletion zones can have knock-on effects, and it's the expanding of them that is the most worrying part. Increased, you know, carbon emissions are the culprit, and that's, you know, fairly well said in the scientific community. And so Oceana's approach to this is kind of to, you know, stop it at the source. changing to renewable energies, reducing our emissions to reduce the occurrence of these oxygen depletion zones. And we certainly should not be expanding our fossil fuel dependence, which will just dramatically increase the rate at which these happenstances are occurring. And so that is the primary reason for our Stop Drilling Before It Starts campaign in the Atlantic. We need to be easing ourselves off of carbon-heavy fuels, and drilling in the Atlantic is not the way to do it. And instances like the news report that you read are just going to become more frequent if we continue on our current trajectory.
Well, thank you, Sarah. So to summarize what I've just heard from you, that if there is one single thing that that could be done to protect our oceans, is to reduce our reliance upon fossil fuels and reverse some of the climate change that we're seeing. Is this accurate?
Absolutely. Oceana is working incredibly hard to try and engage at the state and local level on this Stop the Drill campaign. We have organizers in most of the Atlantic coastal states. We recently had over 150 state, local, and elected officials sign on to a letter to the federal government, to BOEM, saying they oppose this project. We've had over 160 environmental and animal welfare groups submit a letter. The public comment period just closed, but the federal government is still looking to hear people's opinion up until they make their decision on whether drilling should happen in the Atlantic. So engage your congressperson, engage your senators, engage your town councils. There are many ways that you can get involved to try and freeze our carbon footprint.
Okay, thank you, Sarah. I'm going to go real quickly to both of our other panelists and ask them for a quick bullet on the single most important thing in their view that can be done, and then I'm going to try to open it up to the to our audience before we leave. Ali, one thing that we need to do to improve our environment in the oceans.
Well, I've talked about this several times. I think the shift towards a more holistic ecosystem focus of management is the thing we need to do to meet the challenges that climate change is bringing to us.
Okay, thank you, Lee and Nora.
I just feel that the biggest change in everything, I have heard this for the last 40 years, I think the biggest change comes from the consumer. And I think it's the consumer who has to be informed, educated, and demand from the government that there are actually some real changes. And that the government is not completely manipulated or by food companies or by big companies. It has to be, the consumer has all to be together, informed, and stand up that basically it's not anymore endangered species. It's endangering our food supply.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Nora. I'm watching our time and seeing that we're getting close to the conclusion. So what I really want to remind everybody, first off, is to thank all of our terrific panelists, and also to further your learning and development from this session and all the informative sessions of the Spring of Sustainability program. The recordings and transcripts of the full series are available in the Sustainability Action Kit. So for more information about how you can get one, visit springofsustainability.com/upgrade. We've had a great session today. I want you to join us again tomorrow to celebrate Endangered Species Day for two very special sessions. Speakers from World Wildlife Fund Patagonia, the Center for Biological Diversity, and the Endangered Species Coalition will inspire us with a session about why we have hope at 12 noon Pacific and 3 p.m. Eastern Time. And in the evening, you can gather around with your entire family for a conversation and a reading of Dr. Seuss, The Lorax, with actor, director, and environmentalist Ed Bagley, Jr. at 5:30 p.m. Pacific, 8:30 p.m. Eastern. And continue to stay connected throughout the entire series and to engage with us online at facebook.com/springofsustainability. I want to thank you all for listening today, for supporting endangered species through your participation in this program, and by taking action in whatever way you can. I'm Mike Leonard with the Endangered Species Coalition, and have a great day. And once again, thank you for our panelists, Sarah, Lee, and Nora. you did a terrific job, and you made us all a great deal smarter than we were before. This has been a terrific session, and I thank all of you very much. Have a great day.